Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Today I'm going to start with an article from the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Pandemic boredom research is thrilling and might even be helpful. Boredom is a mental health issue, contributes to risky pandemic behavior, and might affect our politics. Boredom is more than just a lack of something to do. It's an unfulfilled desire for satisfying activity, according to researcher John Eastwood. With people around the world under various states of lockdown, isolated at home without their normal social contacts or entertainment options, boredom is a problem. I'm absolutely noticing more people experiencing boredom, says Josefa Ross Velasco, a boredom studies researcher at the University of Madrid. This has been the year of boredom. While COVID-19 pandemic has been rampaging, people who study boredom have taken advantage of these tedious times to learn as much as they can. Boredom itself is a relatively niche area of study, even though it's a universal issue that happens in cultures around the world. It's played, I guess, second fiddle to other emotions that we've studied, said James Dankert, a professor and boredom researcher at the University of Waterloo. But that's rapidly changing. Busy doesn't cure boredom. Contrary to popular belief, boredom doesn't mean you have nothing to do. Boredom is this unfulfilled desire for satisfying activity. It's this desperate urge and feeling where we want to be engaged, but we can't be engaged, said John Eastwood, head of the Boredom Lab at York University, and Dankert's co-author on Out of My Skull, The Psychology of Boredom. I can sometimes feel bored when I'm very busy, like if I'm doing a lot of stuff, but none of it is just really engaging me. I'm just going through the motions. During the pandemic, Eastwood's lab has been looking at some of the emotional triggers for boredom and found that people who had suffered traumatic experiences ended up being more boredom-prone. People who went through difficult events during the pandemic and had difficulty controlling and regulating their emotions reported more boredom later on. Previous research has found that people who are more prone to boredom are people who struggle with self-control issues, narcissism, and anxiety. Boredom is really a self-focused feeling state. You are thinking about yourself and what's missing for you right now, said Dankert. He adds that during the pandemic-related lockdowns, focusing on what's missing instead of what's possible can increase feelings of anxiety and boredom. Ross Velasco suggests that what she calls fast entertainment, like streaming services or social media, might have been fine as a time filler pre-pandemic, but people find them unsatisfying now because they've become their main form of entertainment. With the overabundance of free time, this kind of entertainment fails, and people demand more meaningful activities to fill their time, she said. The problem is that we have spent so much time without having to worry about our boredom and what we really like to do that now we don't know what to do when Facebook or Instagram turns out to be boring. Eastwood agrees that while technology hasn't increased our boredom, it certainly has made us less able to deal with it. People are not more bored now than they were before, but they're more afraid of boredom, he said. And so we may have a greater sense of, I don't know, entitlement to not be bored, or a greater sense of frustration, or even anxiety when we do become bored. At the beginning of this pandemic, I reached out to my advisor, like, are you doing something to research this time? Said G. Lin, a grad student at the Social Cognition and Emotion Lab at the University of Florida. She said no, so we quickly put together the pandemic study. Lynn reached out to fellow students to find out how boredom was affecting their pandemic response and found that students who were more prone to boredom were more likely to move back to campus, despite recommendations to stay home. Dankert's lockdown studies found similar results. Boredom-prone people were more likely to break the rules of social distancing, also more likely to say that they believed COVID to be a hoax. Previous studies had also shown that when some people were made to feel bored, it was such an unsettling experience that they were more likely to develop stronger political views to feel more secure. They try to deal with that uncertainty or that lack of meaning by clinging to their own world views and maybe becoming more extreme in their world views, says Eastwood. Ross Velasco also jumped into action, moving forward with a project she had been incubating for several years, founding the International Study for Boredom Researchers as a way to collect all of these studies together. This society will be a place for researchers to meet each other and to share our research and our papers, just a means to be connected worldwide. She was also able to contribute her research from before the pandemic, looking at boredom among seniors in nursing homes, which suddenly had an even greater sense of urgency. Many old people are having to spend days, weeks, even months isolated in their bedrooms without having contact with their families, caregivers, roommates, she said. In turn, boredom can lead to increased mental health issues, behavioral problems, and sleep disorders. Behavior as a benefit? Not quite. Boredom may not be a pleasant feeling, but its universality suggests it probably has some evolutionary value, perhaps motivating us to action. Boredom is only an emotion we experience. It's not good or bad, said Ross Velasco. What we have to do is learn to live with it, to deal with it, and not to try to avoid it at all costs. Although the internet may be full of lists of tasks to cure boredom and advice on ways to harness its creativity, Dankert said those won't really solve the problem. The idea that boredom will make you creative, it won't. Creativity is a complex thing, said Dankert. If you have fostered and developed creative outlets in your past, then turn to them when you're bored, by all means. And that's a great thing to do. But don't hope that boredom will make you creative. Dankert says that boredom should be thought of as a signal, similar to how pain is a signal that something is wrong and needs to be fixed. It's a call to action. So when we're feeling bored, it's telling us that whatever we're doing right now is not engaging us, he said. Rather than thinking about the things that we could be doing that might be negative or against the restrictions, think about choosing activities that we can do within the constraints that will be satisfying. For Eastwood, the key to preventing boredom is to stay calm and find meaning in the little tasks. Don't panic. Boredom is a normal feeling. It serves a purpose. Listen to its message. It's telling you that you need to embrace the world with more agency and look at it as an opportunity to rediscover who you are and what matters to you. And now we're going to look at a letter to us. Bruce Springsteen's new album gets right to the heart of the matter. And first I'm going to read to you the article by Robert Love, editor-in-chief of AARP magazine. I will let you in on an old interviewer's secret. Start slow and easy, to let your subject clear his throat and get settled in, and to get the two of you talking. Most interviews take flight from there, sounding more like conversations than interrogations, and always ask the hard questions last. When I went to visit Bruce Springsteen at his home for this issue's cover story, and this was December's issue, I opened with this technique fairly confident. Then this happened. Me. So, do you work out in the mornings? Every morning? Springsteen. Yeah. Treadmill and weights? Yeah. I've read that you're a vegetarian. No. No. That's correct. And so it went. My warm-up questions kept yielding one-word and two-word answers. And to my growing alarm, things proceeded this way for the next few awkward minutes. All the while, I was scrambling to recover my wits. But next, in response to a stumbling question about sort of the idea behind this record, his new album, Letter to You, Springsteen locked eyes with me and delivered 11 thoughtful paragraphs about the songwriter's creative process. His self-doubts, his approach to writing, how it has changed over time, and how it hasn't. And from there, liftoff. Springsteen was funny, deep, and thoroughly engaging for the better part of an hour. He talked honestly about aging and loss, about his many lives, and how even seemingly mundane moments like hearing Ben E. King over the stereo at the end of the night can bring you into the presence of the divine. The story follows. I think it's a revealing portrait of a rock star at 71. Longtime readers may know that this isn't the first time Springsteen has appeared on the cover of AARP, the magazine, but it's the first time he's granted us an interview. He felt that Letter to You, with its long view of life, its sorrows and joys, and presented with the full thunder of the E Street Band, would be something you, our readers and members, would like to hear about. I just had to ask the right questions. And that was from Bob. And now on to the article. Part one, The Gift. Bruce Springsteen, looking fit, tan, and perfectly at ease in jeans and a t-shirt, greets me with an elbow bump as we sit down to talk on the porch of his New Jersey farmhouse. The view from here, a rolling vista of 378 acres of beautiful horse country, is perhaps the most visible reward for his lifetime of hard work and outsized success as a rock musician and writer. But it's still a working farm. The busy recording studio is just down the hill, and the 100-year-old barn is a multi-purpose venue. The ground floor, home to his family's six horses, the hayloft, a place for local gatherings, and even a bit of filmmaking. Springsteen turned 71 this past September, a freaky mile marker for many of us who have grown up with him. Though it shouldn't be close to shocking, we have been along for the ride through his many and varied lives, the 70s soul rocker and boss of the mighty E Street Band, the pumped-up stadium showstopper, the writer of iconic, decade-defining songs like Born to Run, Hungry Heart, and The Rising, and more recently, the author of a critically acclaimed memoir, which he transmuted into a one-man show called Springsteen on Broadway. His directorial debut, a concert film for his 2019 album, Western Stars, whetted his appetite to direct again. Oh, and during this pandemic spring and summer, he seized the airwaves to try to raise our spirits and preach mask wearing and patience. Stay strong and stay home and stay together on his fortnightly radio show, From My Home to Yours on Sirius XM. But I am here to talk to him about something quite remarkable for a musical artist of his vintage. His new record, Letter to You, an album of powerful, moving, and elegiac rock music, takes up the great mysteries of life and death as only an earnest pilgrim of 70+1 could hope to pull off. With the full E Street Band, big drums, bass, lead guitars, and keys, the record rocks, and it is age appropriate. Letter to You is an album about carrying on in the face of loss. The loss of old friends, such as George Theis, who sang and played with a teenage Springsteen in his first band, The Castiles. The loss of two beloved E Street bandmates, organist Danny Federici and saxophonist Clarence Clemons. The passing of Springsteen's father, the slow decline of his mother due to Alzheimer's disease, the shedding of lives past, the passage of time itself, the preoccupations of all art that aims for greatness, is at the center of this work. It's a summing up, too, an offering from an old friend. But to whom is it addressed? It is a letter to your younger self, I ask. Is it to your children, your wife, your fans, to me? Springsteen chuckles at the question. It's to you. It's a letter to you, whoever is listening. And yeah, it is a summing up of what I've tried to do over the course of my 45, 50 years now working. The project began with a measure of self-doubt. I hadn't written rock music for the E Street Band in about 7 years, he says. I was thinking, well, maybe I don't have any more rock music in me. True, rock was in the boss's rearview mirror for a while as he embraced other musical styles, covered other writers' songs, traveled whenever his muse set the GPS. For his previous record, Western Stars, the project was a visit to 1960s-era Los Angeles, to the days of Glen Campbell-style folk pop, with lush orchestration. Before that, he recorded and toured with a modern jug band of 17 or more musicians and a repertoire of traditional folk standards and spirituals made popular by Pete Seeger. And whoosh, just like that, 7 years had passed, leaving Springsteen with nagging uncertainty. Could he still write great rock and roll? You never really know, he says. It's part of the anxiety and mystery of the job that I do, which is a magic trick, because you take something out of the air that isn't there. There's no existence of it whatsoever, and you make it physical, literally. You can go for long periods without picking up anything significant, or you'll just pick up different things. It's like you're in a mine, and one vein has gone dry, so you tap into another, a pop vein or a folk vein, and so you start working there. And you discover a whole new rich vein of gold that you can draw from. It's not rock and roll. It's just something else. But because I'm primarily rock and roll musician, when I'm operating sort of at my peak, in other words, in front of my largest audience with my favorite band, I like to, every once in a while, come up with some rock songs. Come up with some rock songs, ho, ho, ho. Just so you know, that last line sprung out to its understated to-do list punchline by a virtuoso storyteller was also delivered with a self-deprecating chuckle. Springsteen is funny in person. He's also fully present, generous in his attention, and to my surprise, as still as an Easter Island statue when he's not talking. I ask if we can avoid politics today. Fine with me, he says, from the opposite end of a family-sized table in front of this pretty fieldstone house. The day has brightened after a morning storm, and Bruce's wife of 29 years, Patty Schiaffle, a tall, red-headed singer-songwriter of considerable talents herself, comes out to check on us, offering drinks and monitoring the social distance protocols at her house. Then the screen door closes and she disappears back into the house. Springsteen is the great empath of the rock world. He shows up for causes, big and small, hunger, poverty, Vietnam vets, 9/11 first responders, hurricane relief, and many more, right down to Asbury Park local. But since our time today is not unlimited, I'm very curious about how, after 50 years on the job, Springsteen still finds inspiration for his songwriting. He answers not as a rock star, but as a member of a tribe, the humble representative of anyone who makes art for a living. You have your antenna out, he says. You're just walking through the world, and you're picking up these signals of emotions and spirit and history and events, today's events and past remembrances. These things you divine from the air are all intangible elements, spirit, emotion, history. These are the tools of the songwriter's trade before he even picks up the pen. people who are very attuned to that atmosphere usually end up being artists of some sort. Because they're so attuned to it, they have a desire to record it. If that desire to record it is strong enough, you learn a language to do so, whether it's painting, films, song, or poetry. My antenna is picking up so much information, I need to find a way to dispense it. So I needed to learn a language that does that. And the language of art, film, records, whatever you want to call it, all of those languages do that. And you get to pass it on to your listeners or fans. That's how it begins. So we're going to pause there for today, and I'll pick it up next time. Now let's move on to Money Saver. Tapping their home for cash. This is from the AARP magazine, and it's by Jean Chatsky. A couple short on money wonder whether a reverse mortgage will help or hurt. The problem. Paula and Dennis Arntz were struggling. To supplement their Social Security, the couple, both 67 and retired, were pulling at least $500 a month from their small bank account. Maybe, thought Paula, they could lose their $1,200 mortgage bill and fix their cash flow by taking out a reverse mortgage on their South Florida home. But she had heard reverse mortgage horror stories, a wife forced to move after her husband died, heirs losing the family home. So many people say, do not do it, she said. Should they? The advice. First, the basics. The most common reverse mortgage is known as a home equity conversion mortgage, HECM. It enables Americans 62 and older to borrow money against the equity in their home with no obligation to repay as long as they live there. Loans come in the form of a lump sum, a lifetime monthly payments, or a line of credit. Reverse mortgages, increasingly popular in recent months, have a reputation sullied by reports of borrowers misled about their risks and consequences, among other problems. Here are questions that potential borrowers need to consider. Is this your forever home? HECMs are costly. If you or your spouse might want to relocate someday, or if your house isn't suitable for aging in place, you're better off selling and downsizing. The Arntzes, who live footsteps from the Intercoastal Waterway, can't imagine moving. How much can you borrow? Your loan limit is based on your home equity, your age, and interest rates. The Arntzes, who owe $88,000 on a home appraised at $340,000, would be able to borrow $189,000. Do you know what it would cost? Mortgage insurance is 2% of the home's appraised value in most cases. Closing costs are similar to those of a traditional mortgage. The lender's origination fee varies and is negotiable. Paula, who shopped around, was quoted figures ranging from $2,000 to $6,000. The Arntz's upfront fees would total $16,000. Where will the money go? You're courting disaster by getting the cash without a plan. If you blow through the money, there's no do-over. But Paula had it all mapped out. After paying upfront costs and their old mortgage, she and Dennis would have an $85,000 line of credit available. They planned to put $18,500 into savings and to leave the rest for emergencies. Can you afford other costs? Though you won't have to make monthly mortgage payments, you'll risk foreclosure if you don't stay current on your taxes, insurance, homeowner fees, and upkeep. For the Arntzes, these expenses total about $500 a month, a figure they can handle. Who is borrowing? If you're married, but only one of you borrows, things can get dicey. For example, if the borrower lives elsewhere for 12 months or more, say in assisted living, the loan will come due and the other spouse will probably have to move. The Arntzes, both borrowers, don't have this concern. What happens after you're gone? Your lender gets back its money, more than what you borrowed, since interest that you didn't have to repay at the time was accumulated on your HECM over the years. Your heirs will have to pay off the mortgage if they want to keep the house, or they'll have to sell the home, receiving any proceeds left over after the lender has been paid. Dennis's two adult daughters are aware of the couple's plan and are on board with it. The outcome? The final step before obtaining a reverse mortgage is a mandatory session with a federally certified housing counselor. It should take at least an hour, says the ARNCES counselor, Eden Lustig of Housing Options Provided for the Elderly. For the couple, the session confirmed that their plan was appropriate. I'm very relieved, Paula says. Now, last time we talked about an article, Black Voices Matter, and I have a few more quotes from it that I'm going to read today. I am not saying the pandemic is a conspiracy to kill or target blacks, but it is illuminating the existing racial disparities in this country that reverberate in everything from health care to jobs, housing, and more. That from Al Sharpton, Baptist minister, civil rights activist, talk show host, 2020. 65 years have passed, and I still remember the face of young Emmett Till. Despite real progress, I can't help but think of young Emmett today as I watch video after video after video of unarmed black Americans being killed and falsely accused. My heart breaks for these men and women, their families, and the country that let them down again. My fellow Americans, this is a special moment in our history. Just as people of all faiths and no faith and all backgrounds, creeds, and colors banded together decades ago to fight for equality and justice in a peaceful, orderly, nonviolent fashion, we must do so again. And that was from John Lewis, U.S. Congressman, civil rights icon. Now, from the dates, I won't have time for all of these, but let's start with 1865, the right to vote then and now. I am for the immediate, unconditional, and universal disenfranchisement of the black man in every state in the Union. Without this, his liberty is a mockery. Without this, you might as well almost retain the old name of slavery for this condition. That was from Frederick Douglass, who's a former enslaved person, an abolitionist, an author, and an activist. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.